essential features and with general sort of iconographic details of Central Asia. But the folds of clothing and garments were Greek. The statue was arrayed as if it was a Greek. Somebody who made that statue had certain Greek ideas in mind and blended them with the ideas that were native to that region. Now, there's an example that is poignant for us now because of recent events in world history, but it's a good example of this spread of cultures that was characteristic of the Hellenistic world. It was a time, many think, of great cosmopolitanism. Cosmos polis, of the world as a city, the city as a world, of the spread of cultures, of people taking on the cultures of other people, other places, other times. Now, I think that if we look for a few minutes at the city of Alexandria, we have some very good insights into what this Hellenistic world was like. Alexandria was really, in many ways, a very dynamic, very creative place during the Hellenistic period. We could turn to other places, but let's use Alexandria as a kind of an example, as a way of thinking our way into this period. The city was founded by Alexander. He founded more than 20 cities, and somewhat immodestly named them after himself, Alexandria. One evidence to his overweening pride, perhaps. This was a city that by 250 BC or thereabouts had probably 500,000 people. By 31 BC, when the Hellenistic world was finally conquered by the Romans, probably 1,000,000. That's a big city in antiquity. That's a big city in the modern world. Now, it was a city known particularly for its scholarship. It was really thought of as sort of a city of great scholars. Most of these scholars worked in a place called the Museum. Now, museum is a Latin word. Museon is a Greek word. The Museon is the home of the Muses. Now, the Muses were the poetic names, the allegorical names assigned by the Greeks to each of the branches of knowledge. You think of Calliope, the Muse of Music, for example. So the Museion was the great house where the Muses lived, but weren't. They lived there in the sense that they were studied there, that they were held dear there. You see, that they were analyzed there. Now, the museum eventually became quite famous, really, as a place where all branches of knowledge were studied. And this began to produce a new kind of person. This began to produce a very different kind of intellectual tradition in the West. Now, I don't want to say we have a 180-degree turn. What I say is we will now generate a tension, and a tension that I dare say is with us still. The people who did this study were learned. They were professional. They were enormously scholarly. They were no longer actually great civic figures. One of the interesting things about the figures that we talked about in Athens, for example, whether we're thinking of a Socrates or a Plato, whether we're thinking of the playwrights or the historians, these were people who functioned in an urban environment, spoke to that urban environment, absorbed that urban environment into their work, spoke back to that urban environment in their work. They were very much anchored in that world. Now in the museum, we have scholars, people who study without necessarily being fully engaged with their world. Culture was an object of study. It wasn't a part of daily life. Learned and elitist scholars began, for example, for the first time, to define literary canons, to decide what criteria of excellence marked those works that should be remembered, should be studied, should be analyzed, and those which were forgettable. They began, for example, to study the various works that existed, to collect many manuscripts of them, for instance, to compare the texts in order to prepare what we would call standard editions, to begin to make definitive editions of texts. They began to try to define taste, to define standards, to sort of say, well, this is what you ought to think. This is what you ought to know. Previously, these kinds of things, for instance, were, again, very much more a part of civic culture. We could say, for instance, to take but one example, Homer's Iliad and Odyssey were in very many ways part of the paideia. Paideia in Greek means the leading up, the training up, the drawing up of a youth. All right? Now, it wasn't as if the youths were sent home at night to memorize sort of 20 lines of the Iliad per night, and over the course then of a few years through their adolescence, they had the whole thing memorized. But it was something that they heard recited, they heard talked about, the stories were told, the messages were told, the morals were registered, you see, of these great books, and they simply became a part of the patrimony of the Greeks. In Alexandria, it would be much more common to study the language, to study the diction, to study the syntax, to study the vocabulary, you see, to look at the Iliad in a very different kind of way. So we're seeing, in a way, the emergence of the ivory tower intellectual. The intellectual who, in a very real way, is divorced from his society, or at least is perceived that way. This is, in a way, a world also that exemplifies the first faint beginnings of what C.P. Snow described in his very famous book, The Two Cultures. Snow was an Oxford Don, and a generation ago, a little over that now, he wrote a book, The Two Cultures. And what he was really talking about is the culture of the arts, the humanities, and so on the one hand, and the culture of science on the other. And he's talking about how in the modern world these two things have become divorced from one another. And there's very often a sort of an inability to study them, you see? You go to any college or university, and if you think about liberal arts, people think, oh, that means you're going to read English and study art and so on. It doesn't mean you're going to study calculus and chemistry. Now, we're going to ask why that should have been the case in some later lectures.